This is Women's Voices and Women's Stories on Yin Radio, and I'm your host, Sandy Billings. I've been nesting lately. With the cool weather and the shorter days, I'm settling into my home. Warm food, warm fire, warm friends. Spending times making the house warm, inviting, and comforting. I'm making my home my place. From KRFP Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and today our theme is homemaking. I have four installments for you today, all about food and home. Let's start with this piece that I wrote and recorded in November 2007. Installment number one is called Food Snob. It's written by me, yes, I am a food snob. My friend Jeannie and other friends, Marilyn, for instance, calls me a foodie. But all they know is that I like food. I like experimenting with tastes, with spices, and with combinations. The juxtaposition of sweet fruit and spicy peppers in a salsa on a hearty whitefish like halibut is so exciting to me. Or maybe the fruit salsas with salmon if I use some strong fruits like blueberries along with some softly cooked bright peppers and onions. And that would look so gorgeous too, with those dark round berries against the bright pink flesh of the salmon. It winds me up to consider the possibilities. Fish is one of the worst for getting me going. And by that, I mean it's one of the best. I mean, I like it a lot. But there's nothing compared to vegetables. I know that's unusual for a foodie, probably, but browsing the aisles at farmers markets, at the co-op, or at any grocery store, I start to see these exciting possibilities, like yams, sliced thick and sautéed with chili and coriander. They're cooked until they're brown, so they have that caramelized outer layer, and it protects that soft sweetness inside. They should be served with something green, charred, cooked only with olive oil and garlic so that the flavor comes through. Or better, go for some Brussels sprouts, which are sautéed until they get caramelized, just like the yams. Iron Chef America, one of my favorite shows by far. The problem I have with that, though, is that I only catch it late at night when I'm trying to settle in. You know, that time when I should be getting ready to relax, tire my eyes down and wind down and slow my mind. Just one thought at a time in preparation for sleeping. But if I catch Iron Chef, I'm instantly hooked, however much I might need to sleep, and I just get spun up. I got two chefs creating four or so new and interesting dishes, and they're using everyday components, things that I can copy. Any one dish might be exciting, but combine them in all of these, and my mind is racing from one idea to the next, and I'm trying hard to log each one for potential experimentation tomorrow or the next day or whenever. But I want to remember this. I want to know it. I want to get it. I want to think about it. It's succulent. It's engaging. I think I've only managed one of these recipes long enough to use it. And the secret ingredient they were using that night was chocolate. And the chef used chocolate powder, cocoa powder, to make a rub for steak. So it was just the next night when I mimicked it. I ground up a little espresso and mixed it with about half as much cocoa powder. A sprinkle of chili powder went in too, and a pinch of pepper. And then the steaks were rubbed and ready for the grill. But now that sounds good, and it was good. But consider the pairings. Charred, cooked in blood orange olive oil. Some pear slices. And some hand-picked blackberries from Julieta. Oh my God. A Cabernet Sauvignon, or a Zin, I can't remember now which it was. It rounded out the meal. And it was superb. The best food is definitely chaste and pure food. It's not covered by heavy creams or tons of butter or lost in cheese. That's just a cheap excuse for not knowing how to cook. And it proves a lack of appreciation for the flavors of real food. If you have any taste at all, you want to taste the food, not all the decoration. Yeah, that's what I mean about being a food snob. I have a sense of disapproval for bad taste, and I am the ultimate arbiter of good taste. Prepared foods, fatty foods, sugary food, processed food, these are bad foods, eaten by people who don't know any better. I first realized I'm a food snob shortly after I joined Weight Watchers a while back, because Weight Watchers has about three major components. They have a system for monitoring and controlling your eating habits. They have a weekly check-in to monitor that progress, and a weekly support and education group. I needed some way to get a handle on my ever-increasing pant size, and my sister had been quite successful with Weight Watchers, so I gave it a go, and it worked. I was hungry a lot at first. I was hungry all the time, actually. Our group leader had me increase the amount I was eating by a little, and that helped. But I did begin losing weight, just a pound or two each week, and the hunger subsided as I learned how to eat better, heavier foods that kept me within my limits each day. And I went to those silly meetings. Yeah, they were silly, and I'm a snob. They talked about how to include cheese substitutes in a meal plan and which sugar substitutes were best. Now, if I'm going to have cheese, I'm not going to have some fake stuff. The real stuff is the only way to go. And I'd rather have one little bite of that real stuff than a whole slice of the fake crap on a sandwich. The sandwich, made with reduced-fat bread and low-fat turkey and mayonnaise substitute at that. So why bother? I'll take the non-processed, fresh turkey meat, lettuce and tomato, perhaps a slice of grainy bread, and call that a meal, thank you very much. And Weight Watchers microwave meals and fake candy bar snacks? What? I'd rather have a nice lentil dal with rice, pack the leftovers for lunch along with some raw carrots, or cooked carrots, spiced with cumin and ginger. The disdain would rise in me at these meetings, and I had to quit going, because busy people don't have the luxury to prep all their meals. Real people don't care about fresh food, especially vegetables and grains like I do. Most think I'm cuckoo, and some of my friends can't even eat the food I prepare. Okay, only one person I can think of, but still, she's a normal person who likes plain tuna sandwiches with nothing fancy added. And please leave the spices out of her chicken and rice. So, anyway, I quit going to those meetings at Weight Watchers before anyone discovered that I was such a snob. I did use the rules of Weight Watchers, and I made foods with lower fat and higher fiber and low sugar, and I met all the fruit and vegetable, protein, and calcium requirements to keep me healthy. And I dropped enough weight in a very reasonable way to wear my skinny jeans again. It was then that I began to allow myself some indulgences, like maybe two glasses of wine with dinner, not just the 3 ounces, like a cookie and two pieces of chocolate in a single day. And after 6 months or so of not logging my portion sizes, they seemed to have doubled. As I got busier, so I couldn't prepare my meals in advance, I started picking up food on the run. The co-op was my mainstay, and always had been since Weight Watchers started at least. But Subway would work in a pinch, too. And then, when I got in a big rush and was so hungry, I couldn't think about waiting to get home to cook food that I hadn't even bought yet, I went to McDonald's. It was my old standby, where I had worked as a kid. I bonded with that food at age 16, and despite our separation during Weight Watchers, my commitment remained. I always liked their burgers. But their fries were the best. Their fries are the best. My friends cringe when I say the name of the place, and they can't even think of eating the so-called food there. But they don't know how comforting it can be about our dark romance. So I sit in my car and I eat my McDonald's cheeseburger and fries, hoping not to be seen by my friends. While I eat, I relish the rich flavor of deep-fried potatoes. I love the feel of the cheese and the meat in my mouth and the satisfaction that only comes from real fat. None of that fake fat stuff for me. As I eat and my compulsion dies down, My mind wanders into later that night. What am I going to cook? Perhaps beets with greens, served with a grilled steak, or grilled zucchini topped with basil pesto, and a shrimp kebab with a whole succulent sliced fresh tomato. Or perhaps that fennel pear and Stilton cheese side dish should be the focus of the meal. Oh, I'm ready and excited to shop and cook now. Man, were those fries good.
My confessions as a food snob. Next up, farmer, writer, Novella Carpenter lives and works in Oakland, California, from her home at Ghost Town Farms. Her latest book is called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. Installment number 2 is from Novella Carpenter. It's about finding the spot that she calls home in an old derelict part of Oakland. She starts by describing some slides of the area, and then she reads from her book.
This is the farm, and it's called Ghost Town Farm because that's the neighborhood. The reason it's called Ghost Town is because it's actually kind of abandoned, derelict kind of area. And I know, like, when I first moved to California, I thought, that can't exist. California, rich people and tan and Porsches and stuff. But actually, no, it's like a really kind of a gnarly area. There's a lot of abandoned buildings and things. And one of the things that's great about it is that there's these abandoned lots. Now, do you see the big, huge green thing here in the center of the thing? Well, that's not my farm. that's actually an abandoned play field. And this is where, like, soccer players play soccer. And lots of, like, hoodlums hang out there and shenanigans happen. I want to eventually take that over and make it into, like, a sheep pasture. But I think that the soccer kids are going to be upset about that. So I'm not doing that. So the farm is actually where the tip of the arrow is. It's that little postage stamp size lot. And I guess it bears mentioning that I'm one of those people that I don't actually rent that lot or own it. I'm a squatter. And so that was one of the things when I moved to California, is like everything is effing expensive, people. So it's really bad. But I knew I wanted to have a garden, and I wanted to have this, you know, chickens or bees or these things that I had done in Seattle. I found this lot, and I was intrigued by it. So that's how that happened. And I want to... I was just going to read kind of how this neighborhood sort of looks. The first thing we noticed when we came down from the hills into the flatlands, also known as the lower bottoms, was the dearth of trees. Gray predominated. My boyfriend Bill pointed out that a dead-end street is a quiet street. And it makes things intimate, he said. Just then, and a dazzling blonde woman with cropped platinum hair and platform boots peeked out of her metal warehouse door and beckoned us to her end of the street. My name's Lana, she said, anal spelled backward. Bill and I exchanged looks. She stood behind her chain link fence, a 155-pound mastiff at her side. A robed Buddhist monk emerged from the house next door. He and Lana waved. He disarmed his car alarm. The danger of the hood trumps even karma. He'd waved, and Lana gazed at the retreating car and said, "The old monk used to make me bitter melon soup when I was sick." Lana told us in her high, funny voice that she had lived on the 2-8 for 15 years. "It's not bad now," she assured us. "A few years ago, though, I had people running over my roof firing machine guns. Now it's like Sesame Street." Lana then pointed at each of the houses and described its inhabitants. A white family she called the Hillbillies in the teal house, a black mom with two kids in a stucco duplex, an apartment house filled with Vietnamese families who wanted to live near the Buddhist temple, an abandoned building with a sometime squatter, an empty warehouse that no one knew much about. As we took leave of Lana, she invited us to Blue Wednesday, a salon for artists and performers she held every week. "She seems interesting," I said, as we walked back to get our tour of the apartment. Our landlords had arrived. "We should move in," Bill said, running his fingers through his shaggy dark hair. He didn't even need to see the apartment. Our soon-to-be landlords were an African couple with socialist tendencies. They led us upstairs for a tour of the bright little apartment. Hardwood floors, a tile-lined fireplace, a backyard, a living room with a view of a 4,500-square-foot lot filled with 4-foot-tall weeds. The landlords didn't know who owned the lot, but they guessed that, whoever they were, they wouldn't mind if we gardened there. We gaped at the enormous space. It had an aspect that would guarantee full sun all day. In Seattle, we tended to what we thought was a big backyard vegetable garden, but this lot, it was massive by our standards. It sealed the deal. Bill and I grinned on our way back to our hovel in the hills, still giddy from too much California sunshine and the prospect of a new home.
Novella Carpenter read from her book at the University of Idaho last month. You can find more about Ghost Town Farm, and you can buy her book, Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, at novellacarpenter.com. That's N-O-V-E-L-L-A, Carpenter, C-A-R-P-E-N-T-E-R.com. And we'll hear more from Novella on upcoming Yin radio shows. Today's theme is homemaking, and we're exploring food and home. Installment number 3, Vandana Shiva is an international leader in food sustainability issues. Anna Maria Roque brings us this piece from Vandana Shiva's presentation at Washington State University in 2008.
When addressing the issue of food away from the Western world, we talk about the lack thereof. World hunger continues to be a growing problem, and when the U.S. is seeing higher food costs and a struggling economy, it has a negative effect worldwide. World-renowned environmental leader and provocative thinker Dr. Vandana Shiva addresses this issue in her keynote address at the Washington State University's International Education Week. She discusses sustainability and the global food crisis, how a global industrial food system is resulting in growing hunger, soaring commodity prices, and food riots. Dr. Shiva, a 2005 nominee for the Nobel Peace Prize, said the World Trade Organization has effectively created hunger around the world. Dr. Shiva, a physicist by training, has spent the last 3 decades fighting against globalization and for the change in the practices and paradigms of agriculture and food. In India, Dr. Shiva established a movement for biodiversity conservation and farmers' rights. Her Seeds of Hope project has restored life to the suicide belt in India and assists communities affected by tsunamis, drought, and the effects of climate change. Her policy advocacy on the international scene has successfully defended the right to seed for farmers and the right to food and water for all. In 1993, she received the Right Livelihood Award, known as the Alternative Nobel Prize, and in 2001, Asia Week named her one of the top 5 most important people in Asia.
When the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches not just a cold, but a serious influenza. So when Wall Street collapses, the rest of the world's financial systems and economic system starts to unravel. The sneeze on Wall Street has spread a financial influenza everywhere. The sneeze of carbon dioxide with the excessive use of fossil fuels in this country has given us climate chaos. That's a serious influenza for the planet. But I'm glad this sneeze of democracy is going to spread worldwide. We know it's going to change things everywhere, because so much of what was happening in other parts of the world was either a direct impact or an indirect impact of what was happening in this country. So this is a virus we welcome, the democratic virus we welcome very much. It must spread and multiply. There are, of course, other viruses that haven't been so good for the world. And just a few weeks of the financial system tumbling down has robbed, I don't know, they say 25 million people in China of jobs is what the assessment is. My own country, the businesses, the big corporations were talking about a similar set of layoffs. The interesting thing is when millions, you know, are driven off the farms and driven off small-scale employment, nobody counts. It's when, you know, the big corporate world starts to lay off that the counting starts to happen. And our prime minister just had a serious meeting telling the corporations that they have a social responsibility. Suddenly, social responsibility is back in currency. It's a word you can use when you talk to businesses, because till 5 years, 5 months ago, it was competition at any cost. The more greedy you were, the more rapacious you were, the better you were, because you were more competitive. And competitiveness had become the religion, and Wall Street had become the church. And the interesting thing is, the whole world was celebrating, but Wall Street was weeping. Did you see how it dropped again? They're crying that democracy won. Tells you something, that those super profits of Wall Street can only survive by killing democracy. They are afraid of democracy. They are afraid of people rising and demanding and securing their rights. So when Wall Street rejoices, people weep. When people rejoice, Wall Street weeps. And the interesting thing will be to watch over the next few months how much damage they can do to this game by using the kind of influence they have always used. The world food crisis is one example of corporate influence that has been a very serious virus that spread worldwide, and this year it erupted in the influenza of the world food crisis. 40 countries had riots. Of course, President Bush was very quick to blame India for it and had a lovely statement. He said, India's getting rich. When people get rich, they want to eat more. They want to eat more like us. And that's why food prices are rising. Of course, every assumption in that statement was a bit off. Because, you know, you can be rich, but if you're a vegetarian, you'll stay a vegetarian. You don't start eating meat just because you got rich. In fact, in the West, there are more vegetarians among the rich than otherwise. And secondly, frankly, if I became super rich, I wouldn't eat the U.S. manufactured industrial food toxic diet. But of course, factually, it was totally false, because in the two decades of development from 1991 to now, Indians are eating less. They're eating less because our basic food security has been compromised to make globalization happen, to create the kind of growth that gets measured in the ledgers of the World Trade Organization, in the profits of Cargill. But in the lives of children and women, it translates into malnutrition and hunger. So, and the average Indian consumption of food has dropped from 178 kilograms per capita per year to 157 kilograms per capita per year. So when President Bush was talking about Indians eating more, wasn't true. What was in fact happening was the U.S. cereal consumption had increased by 12%. But, you know, there's a limit to how much cereal you can eat. I mean, Avery was at dinner today, was celebrating carbs. But, you know, I mean, there's a limit to how much bread, pasta you can eat, how much everything else. In reality, the increased 12% consumption of cereals was not going to feed people in this country. It was going to feed cars, drive cars. And the figures have come out now, a World Bank study that was prepared by the World Bank. And, you know, the World Bank isn't usually very good at telling us real causes, but in this case, they did say that 75% of the rise in food prices now could be explained by the diversion of food to biofuels. The remaining 25%, I explain on the basis of corporate monopolies, integration of the world food system, and all that investment that moved out of real estate and mortgages after the subprime collapse, said, wow, commodities, food, that's where we put our money in to make 25% return, because hedge funds and investment banks don't look for anything less than that. So that's your 100% accounting for the price rise. Of course, unfortunately, both the presidential candidates during the campaign did talk about biofuels as a green solution to the energy crisis and offered it as a solution to energy independence and energy security. Doesn't work out. The math doesn't work out very well, because it takes 1.5 gallons of fossil fuel to produce a gallon of ethanol. It's a net negative energy system. You put in more fossil fuels to process the poor soya bean. In 2006, the U.S. used 20% of its corn crop to produce 5 billion gallons of ethanol, which could only substitute 1% of the fossil fuel use. If 100% of the corn was used for biofuel, and you know what 100% use would mean, it would mean not just the U.S. going without corn, but NAFTA forced Mexico to depend on American corn. So the Americans were having tortilla riots because the price of corn was going up for them. 100% diversion of corn to biofuel would only substitute 7% of the petrol. So you can see 93% would have to be brought from somewhere else. And that means all the land of the world would be diverted, and only a few SUVs of this country could still run. So you'd have to starve the whole world to keep a few SUVs going for a few years longer. Fidel Castro called this a genocide. These are not, of course, the only issues involved. It takes 1,700 gallons of water to produce a gallon of ethanol. Ethanol also means the spread of these monocultures. And all of these shifts in the people's right to food worldwide has meant that people are spending more. The prices worldwide have significantly increased from 2004 to 2006, and 2007 and 8, they shot up even more because of the investment aspect. Corn prices in those 3 years rose by 54%, wheat by 34%, soya oil by 71%, sugar by 75%. Of course, now with the financial unraveling, the commodity prices have come down, but food prices have not. The poor are still spending a huge amount of food. And who's driving this? The corn merchants are the same agribusiness that shaped an industrial agriculture. They are Cargill, ADM, Conagra. For seeds, it's Monsanto, DuPont, Syngenta. For palm oil, which is deforesting the Indonesian rainforests, and from the United Nations assessments, by 2030, all of the rainforests of Borneo could be gone with the expansion of palm oil. One would imagine the Indonesians control palm oil. Cargill controls that too. Soya trade, it's Bunge, ADM, Cargill, Louis Dreyfus. Seeds, again, Monsanto, DuPont. So if you really want to understand the roots of the world food crisis, I think one needs to kind of go back to many of the sneezes that took place in this country over time. Some spread beyond the borders, others stayed here. The Green Revolution was the first attempt at expanding the control of U.S. agribusiness over agriculture in other countries. The interesting name really did not come out because green was popular in those days. It wasn't even in the vocabulary in 65. You know, green is a very recent word in defining the environmental movement. After the Green Party rose to power in Germany, the word green was merely just another color different from red. And red was the terror in China. Because China had gone red, India had to be prevented from growing red. And the analysis was fascinating because they said, if we do not make peasants rich, peasants are going to have a revolution. And they'll go the communist way. So we've got to make them rich, and we've got to bring them into very commercial agriculture. The assumption was, if you make agriculture capital intensive, peasants get rich. Again, the sums don't work out. If I spend more, do I get poorer or do I get richer? A capital intensive agriculture means more poverty, more indebtedness, more loss of land, more creation of landlessness. So they kind of forgot about the debt part, just as recently they forgot that you can't, if you know, you put all of society on a credit spending, sooner or later you'll get into trouble. That's what the whole Wall Street collapse was about, living on credit. The Green Revolution was about credit, and they forgot that sooner or later this is not going to work. But 1965, a drought was used to impose this industrial agriculture on India. Nobody accepted it, except one man who had friends in the World Bank. And they worked it out. So don't worry, forget democracy, forget the parliament, forget even the prime minister of that time, Lal Bahadur Shastri. Now, I got interested in this issue because in 1984, we had the worst violence in the state of Punjab. The state of Punjab was the richest state in India. But people were turning to extremism and terrorism. 30,000 people were killed. And the result of it was, you know, the army and police had to take over the state. I have often said Punjab was six times 9/11, but the world did not notice. I'm a physicist. And to me, there were just two questions in my mind that I had to answer. The first was, if the Nobel Prize was given to Norman Borlaug for creating the Green Revolution, how come Punjab was not a land of peace but became a land of war? What went wrong? And the second was, if Punjab was really that wealthy, why were the people so angry? And by the end of it, I kind of figured out what this thing called the Green Revolution was and wrote a book for the United Nations called The Violence of the Green Revolution and understood then that the roots of hunger were built into it. The first level of hunger was created because actually the Green Revolution, contrary to the popular explanation, was not producing more food. Now, everyone says this is what got India out of famine. This is the secret to India moving from what they call a ship-to-mouth existence. None of it was true. We hadn't had a famine in 65. We'd had a drought, very different. Famine, people die of lack of food. Drought, the rain drops a little bit. And in this region, I'm told you're in the rain shadow. A drought is something that farmers deal with. By the time I'd finished my study, I'd realized per acre we were producing less food. Per acre we were producing less food, but we were producing more commodities. We were producing more rice and wheat that the farmers sold. But we were producing no lentils, no dals, no pulses, no legumes, no oilseeds, none of the mixed agriculture that is required for a full food security in our kind of context of primarily vegetarian diet. If you look at the nutritional per acre or food per acre output, it had dropped dramatically. But the second level at which hunger was being created by the system was when farmers have to take credit to buy the chemicals, they have to sell what they grow to pay that credit back. So ultimately, chemical industrial farmers under conditions of poverty never eat what they grow. They're selling everything. And that's what explains this crazy situation of today, that most of the hungry people of the world are actually rural agricultural producers. This is new. Hunger used to be an urban affair when in 1942, with the Great Bengal Famine, 2 million people died in Bengal because the British took every bit of rice and exported it. It wasn't that we didn't have enough rice in the country, but all of it was exported for the war. All those 2 million, most of the 2 million were in the cities. They weren't in the villages. But today, the 1 billion who go hungry in the world are primarily in rural areas. Primarily in rural areas. And that's because these agricultural systems, on the one hand, constantly take away from the producer what the producer has grown, or after some amount of indebtedness, take away from the producer the very land on which you could have a livelihood or produce your food. With the second big sneeze from the United States that gave the world a huge food insecurity influenza was the World Trade Organization. And we've had trade before. You know, India exported spices centuries and centuries ago. Even poor Columbus was actually seeking India spices. He lost his way and came to this country. And therefore, the Native Americans have always been called Indians because of his error of where he landed. But it was looking for spices. And Columbus was entering the spice trade because we had the trade anyway. If you look at the trade driven by the World Trade Organization today, it is not trade in an excess. It is trade that is creating a deficit. That's why I have called it not free trade, it is forced trade. You're forced to engage in it against your sovereign decisions. But who made the decisions? Who made the decisions of WTO? You know, before WTO, there was created at the same time when, you know, they're going to meet on 15th of November for what they call Bretton Woods II. The Bretton Woods institutions, World Bank, IMF, were created as part of that, and a third little twin called the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, which should have become a trade institution, but didn't, partly because the first meeting was in Havana, and, the U.S. has always had problem with anything in Havana. So the Havana Charter and the Havana model was never adopted till 1995, we get the World Trade Organization. Now, I was very fortunate that I happened in 87 to be invited to a meeting in Geneva. I had no idea all this was going on. But the corporations were all there. And they talked about how they would have a new world order on food. And they laid out their dream. And their dream was only genetically engineered seed, all seeds patented, and total global integration of the food system. I've spent my life defending biodiversity, the integrity of life, the intrinsic value of every species, every person, every race, every gender. And the idea of ownership over life was just, you know, for me, you know, a red blanket in front of the bull. But also the idea that life would be patented meant now it was being assumed that life is a creation of corporations. But it's not. It's scientifically not true. Life makes itself. That's what's so beautiful about life. You put a little seed into the soil and it makes itself. You know, doesn't need permission from Monsanto. Can I grow now? Can I turn left for the sunshine? Can I turn right? It just grows. Grows with the elements. It grows with the soil, with the sunshine. So the idea that seeds would now be treated as the invention of corporations. Untruth, and that's the second thing that really stirs me. I can't deal with untruth. I just can't deal with it. Yeah. You want to get me really engaged, tell a lie. And it seemed half my life, you know, I'm spending so much time just saying, no, it's not true that the Green Revolution produced more food. And it's not true that a seed is an invention. A seed is the embodiment of millennia of years of evolution of that species and centuries of the interaction between human intelligence, the farmers, their breeding. Industrial breeding is very recent, and it can just sort of tinker a little bit. Even when they shift genes around and create genetically engineered organisms, which is when the pattern started, it's a bit like, you know, bringing this chair into this hall. You bring a gene from one organism to another, you bring a gene, a chair from one building to another. Does this movement of the chair turn into the construction of this building? Doesn't, isn't it? Just a movement of a chair. It's a shuffling of furniture. Genetic engineering is a shuffling of genes. You know, you should be putting U-Haul every time they do genetic engineering. But how can you then say you've created the whole thing, and not just the whole thing, but generations and generations of its capacity to multiply, reproduce, be its own thing? Monsanto, along with a group of companies, realized there's big money in this. There's big money if you can own and control life, because landlords only take rents on land and buildings. Lifelords take rents out of every generation of reproduction of a species. So Monsanto, with others, got together and wrote a treaty called the Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. My government, led by an amazing man who I work very closely with, S.P. Shukla, said, but you know, this is nothing to do with trade. How we give patents, how we assign copyright is something about domestic decision making. This is not about trade. So the U.S. lawyers in Washington just went back and put TR before IP, and that's why it's called the Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights Agreement. What a mouthful. Interesting other combination is the same companies that control the seed and biotechnology commercially today are companies that control agrochemicals, and they're companies that control medicine and pharmaceuticals. So they're talking about very large-scale control over life. If just sitting back, buying up companies, a Monsanto can take over the entire seed supply of a country like India, there's no limit to their wealth. Their profits increased 100% last year. On top of it, they increased the price of corn seed. I think it went up from $200 a bag to $300 a bag in the middle of the crisis. But what does it cost to a small farmer in India? In the last decade, we have had 200,000 farmer suicides. 200,000. Why are the farmers of India committing suicide? Well, when the seed costs go up, nearly 100 times is where it went, you can imagine how it changes the peasant economy. So farmers get into debt. And meantime, the Cargills of the world, using all the subsidies from your tax money, overall, in the rich countries, the agricultural subsidy is $400 billion. That's more than $1 billion a day. That's what's causing hunger and the food crisis worldwide. One sneeze in Wall Street can sniff out the life of millions and millions of farmers, but also millions of poor people whose entire economic entitlement changes. If you are poor and are eating one meal a day, when food prices double, All you can do is eat half a meal.
You are listening to Yin Radio, and this is Dr. Vandana Shiva's keynote address at this year's Washington State University's International Education Week. While Dr. Shiva blames corporate influence for the world food crisis, she does have an idea or two how we as individuals and collectively can help solve world hunger.
Well, as an individual, you can just make sure that your eating is not taking away from others. We have a wonderful old Upanishad which says that if you consume more than you need, then you are taking, you know, stealing from either other species, other people, or the future. That's the first. Which means not participating in non-sustainable systems of production, because non-sustainable systems of production are, in effect, taking away other people's ecological space and economic space. The second thing you can do as a collective, I believe, and this is the movements we've been building in India, is, you know, home by home, community by community, village by village. You don't have that many villages in this area, but whatever you have. You know, region by region, county by county, move towards declaring your regions organic, ecological, GMO-free. In Europe, I advise the network of GMO-free regions. There are 48 governments that have said, we don't care what the European Commission decides. We don't care what the World Trade Organization decides. We don't want GM food. We are not going to grow it. We are not going to allow it in our supermarkets. And it's a movement that's growing. It could grow in this country. Now, of course, there are many issues of risk. I don't want to talk about that. But the real issue is power. The real issue is about power and control. For me, it's a serious issue that one company today is controlling the entire seed supply of the planet. It's a very vulnerable situation. And like the House of Cards came down on Wall Street, our entire genetic supply could come down, but the consequences would be much, much larger. So one is diversify Washington agriculture. I'm happy to bring seeds to you. And second is really, you know, promote ecological diversified agriculture in the state. And as I said, if Obama so quickly can run the most important race of this country, surely Americans who've done that miracle can do the miracle of ecological agriculture. That's the next challenge.
This sums up Dr. Shiva's keynote address on sustainability and the global food crisis.
For more about Vandana Shiva and her work, visit www.vandanashiva.org. That's VandanaShiva.org. Anna Maria Roque produced this piece for Yin Radio. Now back to homemaking for our last installment of today's show. Donna Focochon talked to me about homemaking and creating a lifestyle for her family. Donna chose to be a homemaker. It wasn't her only option, and it wasn't dictated by society or ability.
I started out on a real academic track. It started skipping third grade, and because I was so bored in third grade, and went to a French school, and they have this real strong merit system where everyone in the class is given a number and down, you know, from the first to the 30th, and everybody knows the number. And I was the first in the class of the French students, and then graduated summa cum laude from college, and was really on an academic track, and took some time out to teach, and was going to headed back to graduate school. But I've chosen to be a wife and a mom at home. Mm-hmm. I say that about the track that I was on to say this, for me, is a real choice. It's not that I didn't have any other choice. I had myriad other options, but it's been, to me, the best choice, my first choice of what I wanted to do, to be a homemaker, a person who is taking the time to make a home.
And her idea of what a home is, it's a place for family primarily. That's quite clear.
I think that Everybody needs a place where they belong, mm-hmm. where they're accepted, where they're affirmed, where they're secure. They need a refuge, a place where life isn't harsh, but where it's soft. Mm-hmm. A training ground, not a place where they're pampered and spoiled, but a place where they're loved. Mm-hmm. It's a place where a person's identity is formed and where they're made into healthy human beings for the future. The home is where all that happens.
Donna's family moved to France when she was 10 years old. This move had a major influence on her outlook, all these different European ways of living. Later, as an adult, she lived there again with her French husband and raising their kids.
I think that living in France has done a lot towards shaping my view towards how to make a home. Mm-hmm. Americans are so productivity-oriented and so activity-oriented. We lived in France for 4 years when our children were very small, mm-hmm. and then we moved back to the States. We moved back to Birmingham, Alabama. We had gotten used to raising our children in France and had gotten used to the French perspective on life, where what is more valued than productivity is la joie de vivre, the joy of living, where you take time to enjoy relationships, where you take time to enjoy things like eating, where you take time to smell the roses along life's pathway. So we got back to the States, and we were in a good community, a family-centered community even, but it was activity-centered. We were used to, when time off came, when Saturdays came, to having a day just as a family. And we got there, and I felt like my head was spinning, watching the families running to this activity, running to that activity. It was maybe a birthday party for a friend at school, but repeated Saturday after Saturday. Or it was a soccer game, or a ballet class, or this or that. All of them good things. But as I've heard said, the good can be the enemy of the best, because if you're choosing something that's good, that's making you forego the best, you're losing out and you're not having the best.
So Donna decided to just say no to all this activity and to break away from the mainstream and take another approach.
We watched that, my husband and I, and we said, no, we are not going to do this. We chose activities for our children very carefully. They don't have to have every activity under the sun. And when you have multiple children, even the smallest activity for each one means a lot of running. And I didn't want to, by being a homemaker, I didn't want to just be a taxi. So we have really had as a foundational value in our family spending time together in an unstructured way, saying no to good things that would take away the best, the actual relationships that we're building as a family. We enjoy each other. We just have so much. Our favorite people to be with are our children. So I think I brought some of what I discovered in France, that attitude towards life where la joie de vivre is important, where you take the time to smell the roses.
Taking time, finding la joie de vivre. We wrap up this Yin Radio show with spoken word artist Dana Bryant and a piece that harkens back to the opening segment about food.
Yum! Two all beef patty, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions on a sesame seed bun. Mickey D's is central to 42nd and 2nd lunch breaking on the fast track. I'm packing my mini backpack with two Big Macs. There's no time today. I'm late.
But in my heart, if I had my way, I'd take a rhythm and grind break. Truth be told, my ultimate goal is to feed my thoughts and soul with food I never make.
Mama Carolina, masa chicken mafa, mafa legume, goosey soup, fufu. Carolina.
I crave food, lovingly prepared by the wrinkled, supper-stained hands of my grands, with creases in places I remember them to be. Their pots blackened by the oils of 4,000 seasons of history.
Louisiana.
Auntie Ancient's jambalaya recipe with shrimps and oysters or cooked onion rings with slivers of liver, fatback and beans, black-eyed peas, collard greens. Char-char, gullah rice, cocktails in cracked ice, Dixie cups, juice out of strawberry jam jar, sips and soft songs, ham hocks draped in pork bone.
Indiana.
Sustenance, food, a 4,000 season history of Nigerian roadside mama put selling steaming white yams with red stew, yassa chicken, mafa o legume, agusi soup with fufu.
You can listen to past shows or podcast this show or sign up for our electronic newsletter at yinradio.org. You can drop us a line at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP, Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. I am Sandy Billings, your executive producer and host. Assistant producers are Renee Pope and Anna Maria Roque. Opening music is by Piano Chocolat. Yin Radio is a production of VP Foundation. Thanks for joining me. Until next week.
5 after 8, I'm working late. Another day I pass the test of streets doing traffic, people scrambling faster, cars hiccuping, garbage mess. Another day, another dollar. In every way, I play for power, and indigestion's the price I pay to win. But when I take a break, brown bagging it in a public place, I dream cuisine that makes me feel whole again.